Hey, it's Sunday, May 16th. Scott Woods here talking to Bob Dobbs. We're on the 13th episode of the Dobbstown conversation about Richard Meltzer and rock criticism, et cetera, et cetera. How's it going, Bob? Excuse me, how's it going, Bob?
Great, Scott. I'm looking forward to what we're going to do. I haven't read it before, but it's starting at page 248 of The Aesthetics of Rock, which came out about 1970, though written before then. 65 to 70. So I had scanned this a little bit 6 months ago and made some, highlighted some paragraphs, but I don't remember what it was. So let's go into it. Do you have a statement to say first?
No, I'll just say that this was one of the excerpts I sent to you because I think this is sort of a really key section of the whole book. And you know what, I can't even begin to explain why, because it's been a long time since I've actually read it, but it goes into a section that actually does get quoted sometimes when, you know, when people do write about this book, about the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper and signaling the death of art forever and that sort of stuff. So I figure you're going to have a lot to say about this. So, yeah, let's dive right in.
Oh, it's the end of the book, because the epilogue is on page 259. It's the last part of the book.
That's right. It's the end of the book before the epilogue. But the epilogue itself is more great stuff as well. But.
Oh, okay. All right. So he says at the top of page 248, but the question remained, is the actual total rock demise possible? Can the whole thing collapse for real? Now, is he's dealing with what he considers the death of rock in 68 and 69, right? So he's saying it's kind of dead, and he's wondering how deep the death is, right?
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah. So he says, Eric Burdon's, quote, story of Bo Diddley, is that a song?
That's a song, yeah. Yeah.
Eric Burdon's story of Bo Diddley reflected upon an earlier rock crud consistent hypothetical abyss. Reflected upon an earlier rock crud consistent hypothetical abyss, one sort of earlier analog situation, that period during which Bobby V had hits, in brackets, Take Good Care of My Baby. Great song. I like that song. Had hits, page 2, footnote 210. Sure enough, prophetic in reverse, non-affinity-minded Eric Burdon is, so Eric Burdon is prophetic in reverse and non-affinity-minded, that means he's not aligned, I guess,
okay,
is fortunate to have been forgotten for his analysis by the time of the reemergence of Bobby V. At the very height of the Sgt. Pepper, returned infallible quality hoopla. Returned to infallible quality hoopla. So at the very height of Sgt. Pepper, 67, right? Not some replay of Sgt. Pepper.
At the height of it, yeah.
Okay. So I don't remember that, but I guess he emerged a little bit. But see, there he is monitoring the music industry, and he notices these little gradations. Bobby V came back. Do you remember the Bobby V came back? No. You're too busy listening to Sgt. Pepper. But then Eric gloried in Bo Diddley's rejection of the Animals' version of the latter's old stuff. So if he knew about the return of Bobby V, he might snicker. Eric gloried in Bo Diddley's rejection of the Animals' version of the latter's... of Animals' version of the latter, meaning Bo Diddley's old stuff, eh?
Right, right. Well, and Bob, just so you know, I just pulled out my Billboard book to like the top 100 hits list, and Bobby V did actually, he did kind of reemerge. Well, he had hits all throughout, but he reemerged on the chart in a bigger way in 1967. He had a couple top 40 hits. So,
what were some titles?
One of the titles is actually kind of funny, Beautiful People.
Yes.
And Come Back When You Grow Up.
Oh, yeah, great song. See,
I don't know that. I don't know that.
Oh, man, it's great. All this music is so beautiful. Just mentioning it makes me warm inside of all those songs. I've always listened to the oldie stations and the new stuff. I've been scanning everything for 40 years, so it's all really good stuff. You know, I don't have these distinctions that he's trying to work out, but at the time we understand why he's trying to create a value hierarchy here, you know, because no one knew where it was leading and where is it going. So what's good, what isn't? So,
well, all this stuff he's writing about would have been part of a conversation at the time.
Yeah. So he's saying that Eric gloried in Bo Diddley's rejection. Where is the return there? Because he goes, so if he knew about the return of Bobby V, he might snicker. Oh, okay. So he's he's glad that Bo Diddley rejected him, because that's the old guy, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. And so Bobby V is returned, and then the Animals are returning Bo Diddley, but their version. The Animals' version of Bo Diddley, right?
Right.
So it's like a replay of Bo Diddley, but it's different, just like Bobby V is a replayed, and he's from an earlier era. So I'm not sure what... Let's see if the paragraph here explains. So he's saying, Eric Burdon's story of Bo Diddley, reflected upon an earlier rock crud consistent, has to be consistent with crud, hypothetical abyss, one sort of earlier analog situation, that period during which Bobby V had hits, right? Everybody knows the Bobby period, right? It's after Elvis went to the army, and Paola was gone, and just got controlled more. It says, Highway 61 Revisited, Rubber Soul, Aftermath, Blonde on Blonde, Pet Sounds, Revolver, Between the Buttons, all awesome albums, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Etc. were super-duper gap fillers that just scratched the itch.
That's good.
Okay, Donovan's first full rock album, Sunshine Superman, appeared, and It's Celeste, a song called Celeste, offered the focal point of non-objective private vulnerability to mere whim, which might easily be generalized to the level of public as widespread private. So maybe we needed to read the many pages before this, because I might be missing the particular context, you know what I mean? I mean, we're jumping 130 pages, so let's see what we can figure out here. Super-duper gap fillers. So the itch. What is the itch about? I'm going to read another paragraph. Rest became a move, replacement of the expected periodic reappearance of official crud. So there is, he knows the recycling of things. Rest became a move, replacement of the expected. So he's saying that something else replaced the routine replay or retrieval.
Right.
For the Beach Boys, it was resignation to and systematic acceptance of utter peace in Wouldn't It Be Nice. For Dylan, it was the systematic preference for repetitive Muzak structural laziness. For the Beatles, it was, quote, I'm only sleeping, and the return of surrealism to the dream qua sleep. But for the Stones, it was Mother's Little Helper, the pill illustration of the close proximity of death to relaxation. So everybody else is relaxing, the Beach Boys, Dylan, and the Beatles, but the Stones aren't.
Right, right.
Proximity of death, or pointing out that relaxation is close to death. And the Yardbirds' Farewell is a comfortable suicide song per se, or at least a farewell to future days full of insulated rest. So this rest is, you know, McLuhan said at the time that he talked to John Lennon, he said contentment came to the British Empire, to England, because it was after World War II, and it was a kind of happy days feeling, eventually, at least by the time of Swinging London. And so it's interesting, this contentment or rest. But by the late 60s, everything gets on the move again, because everything's really psychedelicized and unpredictable. So rest became a move. So let's move forward. We'll figure out what he's saying here. Then there came the Grateful Dead and the Doors. Doors and willingness to die, lose, etc. Not just obsession with the inevitability of death or speculation. Okay, not just obsession with the inevitability of death, or speculation on laying the groundwork for future necrophiliac moves, but the need to do some killing. So, you know, I used to say everything's disappeared. Well, McLuhan understood that by the 60s. So he's understanding the death of communication, the death of, it's what Baudrillard wrote about after the orgy. Everybody was just satiated. And there's so much wealth coming out in the 50s and 60s that at a certain point people like the pods on Zappa's Uncle Meat Beanstalk, in the description in the story that comes with the album, 1969, the pods go up, and he says it's like a Jack and the Beanstalk. So Jack goes up, and the pods go up, and they fall off, and he ends with the image of the pods falling off. Zappa's watching the turnover of hits and groups. So this is similar to, I'm getting, to what there's a kind of exhaustion at this period,
right.
and he's showing how the groups dealt with this rest or this exhaustion. So the rest became a move. So he's saying that people turned exhaustion into an art form, into entertainment. They're super duper gap fillers that just scratch the itch. The itch is something more profoundly difficult, the abyss. So then he says, the end. This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end. No safety or surprise. The end. I'll look into your eyes again. That ends all doors performances, he says, with the final line being, this is the end. There's a, quote, father, yes, son, I want to kill you section in it, and a big kill chorus, the note on that. Sometimes it sounds on the recording like care, but that's certainly close. So he's saying kill might be care. There's a Tristan and Isolde-type revival of the sex-death relationship, plus a willingness to succumb to it. Now, I don't know if you were... Would you have known who Tristan and Isolde was when you were young and read this, Scott?
No, definitely not. No.
Yeah, it's a major theme in Finnegan's Wake. But you know who it is now, right? This medieval couple?
Vaguely, but maybe go into it a bit.
Yeah, Tristan kills the father of Isolde and steals her. I think Isolde was to be married to this king. And he kills the king or steals her from the king and takes her away. So it's a stealing. There's a Tristan and Isolde type revival of the sex-death relationship, plus a willingness to succumb to it. I can't remember. Maybe Tristan and Isolde probably end up dead in some way. Plus a willingness to succumb. There's a revival of it, sex-death relationship, plus a willingness to succumb to it. See, you can get into how the chemical body is being obsolesced by the discarnate electronic body. And so all these death scenes and moods in the chemical body or the physical body are superseded by you can carry on even though your body is like dead in so many ways. Remember McLuhan was saying around this time that sex was dead. He wrote that to Playboy. But Vietnam wasn't, because everybody was involved in the meaning of Vietnam as it was laid out on the media. So people were very involved with the discarnate body and not so much exhausted on the physical level. So that's why you can have a sex-death relationship plus a willingness to succumb to it, to succumb to one quarter of yourself, or back then one half yourself, just the chemical body, because you can still process information. And that could be the itch, the super-duper gap fillers. These are gap fillers because nobody knows what to do with themselves when they got these two bodies. They fail. No music, no art form can assuage the ongoing itch that you need to keep experiencing the discarded entertainment. Doesn't stop. So no matter what you do, and he lists off these great albums, they are, so when he says rest became a move, it's almost, as he said, necrophiliac. It's necrophiliac. And for entertainment in terms of the chemical body, is minor compared to the stimulation you get from watching TV or buying your FM radio or speakers and all that stuff you get. The more and more highly developed record industry entertainment apparatus, that's the junk. That's what people are addicted to. So the content is transitory. So he's talking about this, the old values of the chemical body in arriving at some determined point of success or satisfaction is not possible. So that's why you have the contradiction of rest, death of the chemical body, becomes the gap filler content. So you celebrate the death of the chemical body like the Doors do. So let's see if this is supported. And he says, and I looked at you, a Door song, in brackets, you looked at me, I smiled at you, you smiled at me, and we're on our way, and we can't turn back. An end to directional options, see? The chemical body's normal, moving through past, present, future timeline. You don't have that when you have an information surround. You know, whenever you can tune into anything, anytime, on your media.
Right.
So there's no direction in chemical body or practical terms. There's just consumption.
Right.
And we're on our way, and we can't turn back to the chemical body. So then he quotes the Kurt Weill Brecht song, Alabama Song, Whiskey Bar. was chosen for the Doors repertoire, most likely because of the death, in brackets, Surely We Must Die, and Mother, because of the death, Surely We Must Die, and Mother reference. I turn the page here. Mother references. So, the mother, we've lost our dear old mama. So, the Doors repertoire, most likely because of the death, and Mother. So
they grabbed this old Whale Brecht song because it resonated with the whole death thing.
Yeah, negativity, very negative stuff.
Yeah, and the Kurt Weill stuff is often kind of cited as being a bit pre-rock in that way, actually.
So here you have Jim Morrison may not, he's a poet, he's feeling the death of the chemical body urges, he's reading McLuhan, but he might not get what's really the factor in here, the endless, the gaping maw of the discarnate body. And then so he gets lost in drugs to keep up with the massage that the discarnate body is doing to him.
So the foot. Jim Morrison or Richard Nelson?
Jim Morrison.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm talking about what the Doors presented. I mean, it's all this death stuff, but people love it, and the music's good, but if they actually listen to the lyrics and thought about it seriously, like Meltzer does, they might say, why am I dancing to this death stuff?
Right.
But the point is, it's the death of the chemical body, which is minor compared to the ongoing entertainment stimulation of the electronic body. So he has a footnote after Mother, death and Mother references. Of the twin life principles, mother and father, of the twin life principles, mother and father, only the mother affords an eventual sexual union, further conventionally repulsive/wholesome death consolidation moves. Read that again. Further conventionally repulsive, wholesome death consolidation moves. The father can only be killed outright. So the mother affords sort of some kind of move, some kind of reminder of the chemical body. So, okay, so you got that, and then you go to the next page. And Moonlight Drive, that song, the nihilistic topper of, okay, and Moonlight Drive, the nihilistic topper of patches. And he says, just a little join me for some suicide, in brackets, we're both still alive, down at the wild old ocean, in brackets, tide and all that, not a dirty old river. See, so he's, it might be striking if you're not aware of the discarnate body back in the 60s reading this or hearing this stuff, but the chemical body has become a gap filler. Let's abuse the chemical body. This is the beginning of the abusing, celebrating in content, in entertainment content, the abuse of the chemical body, because the consumption via electric body is the prime concern of people's lives. They just keep the chemical body around because you've got to have some ears to listen to the stuff.
Right.
Okay, so then he says, come on, baby, going to drown tonight. And then end of the night. Then he has another song, Take It As It Comes, which chops up turn, turn, turn into a non-polar, non-preferential. See, there's a great apathy here about what's being done to the body. Into a non-polar, non-preferential list. Time to live, time to lie, time to laugh, time to die. And of course, quote, when the music's over, that song, take the end of anything pertinent, take the end of anything, so the death of anything pertinent, as the opportunity for turning out the light. And turning out the light means ignoring the values of the chemical body. Death as the end metaphor, and death of the end metaphor. Now look, there's my point, he always does it. Death as the end, that's a metaphor. And death of the end metaphor. And you get that? Death of the end is, it's not real end when you have an electronic body. It's only, in other words, the chemical body's dead, you can play with it and abuse it, but you're still alive and consuming on the electric body level. So there is no end, as McLuhan wrote in Culture's Our Business, came out the same year as this. He said, he ends the book with, there is no finish line. Because as long as you're engaging all the values and stimulus, I mean, that's why junk food took over. The people didn't care about what, they just sort of did token eating because they were mainly eating electronic entertainment in their cars and whatever, processing information. So that doesn't die. So this is, again, easy to explain. And then he says, Dylan.
You skipped a footnote there too, Bob.
Oh, okay. Well, let's do the footnote. That's 213. Yeah. So he's talking about death as the end. Death is the end as a metaphor, and death of the end metaphor for a while. It's all transitory because a whole new mood happens every 18 months. So there's going to be a new content kind of slant that'll be popular.
And if earlier he's talking about the gap filler, then that would imply that there's something at the other side of the gap, right?
That's right. Or it doesn't. It fills a gap, but the gap is always being continuously created.
Right. Okay.
So what I remember, basically, what it flips into is Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Neil Young, and Don McLean. Those kind of depressing, folky
singer-songwriters.
Yeah, that they come in about 69, 70, 71, right?
That's right. And Mitchell and, yeah.
And James Taylor, and it was horrible. But, I mean, now when I listen to it, it's all right. It's okay. I don't have a reaction. But I wanted the energy to keep going, whatever I thought was happening, and I found Zappa did satisfy that. You know,
well,
but,
one of Lester Bangs' key articles from the time is called James Taylor Marked for Death.
Yeah, yeah. But we all, us living people or alive, noticed the... It was all part of the Kent State and bum out, you know, depress the baby boomers, you know, after Neolithic orgiastic 60s. It was almost programmed to make it depress everybody, to say, oh, you failed and all this, it was the end of the revolution. Yeah, well, I didn't fall for that. Me and Frank didn't fall for that. Right. Dylan did a little bit with his John Wesley Harding and National Skyline and Self Portrait and New Morning. But he caught up with us by what, the album Desire in 1975 or something.
Right, right.
But Frank held the... See, this is the thing. We could write a counter history how Frank carried the torch. But you had to like Frank. If you didn't like him, you were lost. You know?
Yeah,
If you didn't gravitate towards music, you had nothing. You'd end up being an idiot listening to James Taylor. And Neil Young, he developed himself a little better later.
Yeah, well, even that, I mean, he was someone I think who had sort of more credibility from the start, just because the exterior of his music was kind of, you know, easy going for a while, but he was actually writing about some pretty tough stuff too.
Yeah,
he wasn't as simple to classify in some ways. So.
Right, and it's shown later. You know, he had anger in him, or he had energy. So. What was his famous song? Rock, hey, hey, rock ain't gonna die or something?
Yeah, hey, hey, my, rock and roll will never die. And that was kind of in response, that was directly in response to punk.
Yeah, and it was almost like, hey, hey, I'm not gonna die. I still can consume, there's good music to consume. He's just celebrating his own consumption of punk music.
Yeah, well, and he had it's better, because rust never, it's better to burn out than it is to rust and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that can be applied. You can always, on the surface, would be puzzlers for the average baby boomer mind. They're totally understandable what they're saying if you bring in the two-body idea, or the two-level.
Say that again?
That sentence you just said about rust, they might sound like word twisters, contradictory, hard to figure out for the average baby boomer consumer back then. But they're totally understandable. They're talking about two different bodies, two different landscapes.
Right, right.
It doesn't make sense if you're talking about one chemical body and has this contradictory stuff going on. It makes total sense when you understand that the discarnate body has a whole consumption mandate that's being satisfied. So your chemical body might rest, but you won't rest if you keep tuning in.
Yeah.
I mean, the larger part of yourself, which has been added on to with the electronic body. Okay, so, and Dylan's, okay, the footnote for this death of the end metaphor, but the Velvet Underground sure forced the issue, Black Angel's death song, heroin, quote, when it shoots up the dropper's neck and I'm coasting in on death, Venus in Furs, that song, Venus in Furs, with non-death-oriented sadomasochism, persist in self-negation. See, the Underground were diehards for the death scene, for the death. Okay, so he says, and Dylan's earlier but finally becoming pertinent narrow escape from death on his motorcycle. So
it's like death was very pervasive. in the music scene at that, and that, you know, it does seem obvious. I mean, you listen to the stuff from that period, and yet you take into account the Dylan motorcycle accident and all that. It's like death was really in the air, and I mean, that's, you know, from a couple of years previous, it seemed like everything was so full of energy and life and all that. So.
Right. So, I mean, Dylan's death or motorcycle accident is July 29th or so, 1966. The hippie thing. See, you got different levels here. You got the hippie media San Francisco eruption of delight and so-called new energy. That's happening while some of the bands are doing the death stuff. And the death stuff is usually older guys like Dylan and Jim Morrison, who have been doing drugs for a few years and are got a dead chemical body. And they might even become famous, or they do, but they not sure if they like the fame, the electronic body.
Right.
So they are puzzled by the continuation of the electronic body, but their body doesn't have the energy anymore. The chemical body is disillusioned. So, there's a point there. What were we just saying? The living energy in the TV landscape. But, you see, the hippies are 67, 68, and it's like a naive outburst of a certain age group energy, but the actual gods they like to listen to, like Dylan, are going through problems themselves because they've been doing the electronic thing for a couple of years or being the content on it, whereas the hippies now, they're trying to get media coverage. They think that's going to lead somewhere.
Right,
they're naive, believing in their... you know, Summer of Love revolution, just get us on the medium, but let her put her message out. And the actual messengers, the rock messengers that inspired them, are collapsing all over the place because you can't keep up with the insatiable demand. And no matter what you do, you will burn out and a new mood will come in, like that folky mood. And then that flips in. The folky mood flips into Yes and Genesis. What do you call that, progressive rock or something?
Yeah, prog rock, yeah.
And then that flips into disco and punk, and then punk flips into techno, and then techno flips into rap.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, all the time, the Bobby V level is still going for those audiences.
Right, okay.
You know, they're not on the main. It's only the new stuff that gets the hyper attention.
So what was, I mean... Frank Zappa does kind of have an interesting placement sort of within that whole period, because, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but, I mean, he kind of came out of the starting gate kind of, you know, as almost as nihilistic as any of them about, or I don't know if nihilistic is the right word, but very, like...
Yeah, he wasn't celebrating death.
He wasn't celebrating like the peace. He was mocking almost the peace.
He was mocking. He was more technical. Here's the thing for Frank. He was mocking the electronic landscape. He was not into whatever revolutions the people thought the body could do, the chemical body. He was mocking the president of the United States and the media imagery. He was actually the most tuned in. I would say Dylan and Morrison, them, they didn't know how to handle, and I've always said this, Frank knew how to handle his fame. He did not have chemical body issues, other than he worshipped the ear, and he wanted to, you know, stimulate the ear and keep up with the electronic drug. Outdo
right.
it. And therefore use any kind of sound. But, I would say Frank was targeting Dylan, he targeted the Beatles. Well, what's he known for? He made fun of the very media thing that the hippies and baby boomers were into.
Yeah.
And Dylan kind of did it with John Wesley Harding. He was mocking the whole scene. You can read the story in the back and how that fits the scene. And that's when he's up in Woodstock hiding. Hiding from his media image. Zappa had, it's almost like he held back and watched, and then he had the edge because he knew what Dylan and them went through, and he didn't get bothered by it.
Yeah, well, what about the Stones were kind of interesting too, though, because they were
like a step between, you know, Dylan.
Yeah,
they were in
yeah.
between. What they didn't get as far as Zappa, but they weren't naive. Like,
right, exactly.
The
that's what I was trying to get at. They weren't naive. I mean,
right, and so. But they still dealt with the chemical body. They Wayne had no clue. Well, you could say their Satanic Majesty's Request was an attempt to create a media propaganda thing. I like some of that album, but that was their Sergeant Pepper's, and they gave that up. They said, well, they quickly realized, no, it's stupid trying to do a media agenda or something. Or
Yeah, exactly.
And but Zappa didn't have to learn that way. He knew from square one. And that was his appeal. He was cynical about, or entertaining and ironic about, the very fact that he was performing for you and being made famous in the counterculture anyway. So, yeah, that's it. It's good. We come to this point that Zappa is, who are the Brain Police? You know, when me and Bob Marshall asked him in the interview in 1988, 22 years later, who are the Brain Police, Frank? He says, I'm still working on it. And that is a very intelligent answer. Because we're trying to figure out what the media dynamics here are of the several landscapes.
Right, right.
It's like figuring out the relationship between George Orwell and Brave New World, you know, Aldous Huxley's, plus maybe McLuhan. Figure out which is the problem here. What's causing what seems to be a demise of the chemical body and chemical body institutions. God is dead.
Right.
So, so Dylan's earlier but finally becoming pertinent, narrow escape from death on his motorcycle. So Dylan was the first. He goes through the death thing, and then as the death happens to the chemical body on a broader scale, and the Doors and the Velvet Underground start popularizing that, then you look relook at Dylan's death, or I mean almost narrow escape from death, right?
Right, right, yeah.
As a media image. So then he says, then along came the Beatles again with Strawberry Fields Forever, with an important forever on top of the Doors, signaling the death of past actual eternities. That's totally understood. Past actual eternities were chemical body issues. The death of the chemical body issues, because they're superseded by the electronic immortality. I mean, Elvis is immortal in the electronic landscape because they're always replaying it. Anybody can consume Elvis. Thousands of YouTubes or whatever, right? And they recycle and reprint his albums. Nothing, as I used to say, nothing stopped. Nothing. We stopped in 1945 and it's endless. Everything is immortal at that point in the new electronic landscape.
Right.
It's recorded. It's there forever. So what do? They take, you know, all the jazz catalog and they made it CD. What was it? CD. And then they made it digital. They would have to reformat the thing, you know, through the 80s,
right, right,
through the different technologies, right? So it's always there. Okay, so there's no death in the electronic scape. There is death of values associated with the chemical body. So signaling the death... What?
Yeah, no, that's making a lot of sense. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, signaling the death of past actual eternities. So how can you kill an eternity? But it's the actual eternities of the chemical body, as laid out in religion, that dies, closing off the non-nostalgic present. See now there, you know, this is interesting, that phrase. I've said that there is no such thing as nostalgia. You just have endless replay and accessibility, and someone today could hear Elvis, you know, 18 years old, and like it. You never know what anybody's going to like, and it's all new for them. So it's not, in that kid, it's not nostalgia. It's a present, electric, eternal present containing a lot of content, closing off the non-nostalgic present and stuff like that. So he's saying that the electronic present has been closed off by the Beatles. I would say there may be some more explanation here, but at this point I'd say the Beatles thought they had arrived somewhere, some utopian image. That's what they're hoping for the chemical body. But you don't arrive anywhere with the electronic body. It's just endless stimulation.
Right, right.
So it's closing off they are trying to close off what they can't close off, the non-nostalgic present. So then he says, and the death is certainly all over the place for a while. So that would be a kind of retreat, I think, or at least the dream location of it, which in this case heightens confusion, both a posteriori and a priori, or something like that, sleep as a surefire actual conceptual death hyphen closure, etc. Now, we look at the footnote. I'm going to go back over this. Footnote 214. The abundance of... What?
No, keep going.
Yeah. The abundance of that is like construction in strawberry fields is the most overt clarification and simultaneous non-formalization of raunch epistemology ever, indicated by such massively fluid knowledge guidelines as, quote, it must be high or low, and all wrong, that is, I think I disagree. You know I know, and it's a dream, or you know I know when it's a dream, or whatever that is, you can't make it out exactly, and it doesn't matter, it always includes opposites, which is the chemical body's perspective, and it's obsolete. Or whatever that is a perfect reversal of Platonic Cartesian certainty for being awake knowingly only when you're actually awake. Now, any of these things that we're talking about can be understood if you see you have two bodies. Because he's flipping between describing one body and its death, and then the ongoing non-nostalgic present, which is forever being pumped out, that you're engaged in.
Okay.
So the last prior time this type of philosophical reversal occurred was in the song I Want to Tell You. Quote, it's only me, it's not my mind that is confusing things. Now, if you took that, you know, this is juvenile, but it's only me, the chemical body, it's not my mind, and my mind is processing the discarnate information constantly. Right? Remember,
say that again, the last, it's only me
as his chemical body, but his mind, which is in the mind, you could say the brain is in the chemical body, but the mind is the ongoing knowing processor of electronic information.
Electronic, yeah, okay.
Which he, in a simple way, he says, calls it my mind. Okay, so do you see how you can look at these contradictory slipping and sliding if you know he's just not telling you there's two bodies going on?
Right, right.
So, or whatever that is a perfect reversal of Platonic Cartesian certainty, that's chemical body literary perspective, for being awake. It's a reversal for being awake knowingly. So, reversal of certainty for being awake only when you are actually awake. Let's see that. Whatever it is, a perfect reversal is for being awake knowingly. So, if you're awake knowingly, only when you are actually awake, there's a reversal of that. It's a perfect reversal of certainty for being awake knowingly only when you're actually... So only when you're actually awake is the limited condition of the chemical body when you have this other environment around it. That's what's going on there. You think you're awake knowingly, but any knowingness that the chemical body or brain can have is subservient to the incomprehensible ongoing present electronically, the electronic presence. So you can't get awake in chemical body... guru terms, mystical or philosophical, if you don't recognize there's another landscape that you're processing. That's why McLuhan was the most important. He was saying, hey, all those certainties, philosophical certainties or conditions of enlightenment are irrelevant when you're processing a whole other body. How can you stop? You can't stop that. So how can you get out of that dream that the media consumption gives you? The only way is to turn it off. So let's go back into this thing about the Beatles. And the death is certainly all over the place. Now, certainly all over the place would be people see the Beatles and the Stones. They're famous. They're traveling all over the world. Their chemical body is, you know, in Help and that. They're filming down in the Caribbean, you know, the movie Help. So the world is their oyster. They're traveling all over the place. That's what every teenager would love to do. Not be seen in school, but just going all over the world like the rock stars were doing.
Exactly.
But that's just a chemical body desire. Everybody is all over the place just by watching TV.
Sure, yeah.
So the death is certainly all over the place. So the death of, the Beatles have stopped being the Beatles at this point. They quit in 66. So they don't want to go traveling around, as John Lennon said, and just talking to mayors of towns. It's no fun.
Yeah.
The death is certainly all over the place. That means chemical body mobility for a while. Or at least a dream location of it. Yeah, it's a image the chemical body has from the media, that there is a world out there you can be a tourist in.
Yeah.
That'd be one way to look at the dream location of it. So it's a dream because you bring in the electronic imagery, which in this case heightens confusion. Yeah, that's all you're getting here is confusion about the two bodies, which doesn't mean obviousness is lessened. Yeah, obviousness is what your digital senses are seeing. You're processing the news and information. It's obvious. It is. It's real, right?
Right.
So it's the confusion, which doesn't mean obviousness is lessened. Well, that's because discarnate perception is obvious. It's only confused when you don't know that that's another body separate from the chemical body. When you try to lap overlap chemical body issues over to the and not know it's that this kind is mixed in there, you'll get confused.
Okay.
Yeah. Which in this case heightens confusion both a posteriori, that's after, and a priori is before, or something like that. See, he's correct, it goes something like that, because even to say this is different from that, it's chemical body, literate categories, which blur in the discarnate landscape.
Right,
okay. So he's often explaining the discarnate landscape and talking about the confusing, strange issues, traditional certainties of the chemical body life. So he says, sleep as a surefire actual conceptual death closure, etc. So you can't go to sleep when your mind knows the electron environment is going on 24/7. You can experience chemical body sleep, but it's only, he says, a surefire actual conceptual death closure. So to kill the chemical body has been superseded by the electronic body, so there's that kind of death. It becomes conceptual when you understand that it's the electronic body, so that is, doesn't sleep, sleepless in Seattle. Sleep as a surefire actual conceptual death closure. Okay, since you can't fall asleep, this is more dealing with an effect on the chemical body as a result of the 24/7, no finish line digital environment. Sleep is an attempt to kill yourself, to shut yourself off from the electronic processing, and it can, you can't do that, so it's only conceptual.
Okay.
Sleep is a surefire actual, you actually go to sleep in chemical body terms, but it's only conceptual in relation to the electronic processing, which doesn't stop. That makes sense. So he's really, okay, let's now read the footnote again. The abundance of that is like construction.
I guess that must be, I'm trying to think of a song. Yeah, that is, you think, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That is it. Yeah.
It's a repeating phrase.
Yeah.
The abundance of that is like construction in strawberry fields is the most overt clarification and simultaneous non-formalization. In other words, it's so obvious. Here's this phrase, which is verbal, which is talking about chemical body terms or conditions, and cannot deal with the electronic thing. You can't categorize electronic processing. So you verbally, it's most overt clarification. You're actually showing that you can't define. You know, that is, you keep doing it. And
yeah.
Some say it's non-formalization of raunch epistemology ever, because you can't formalize in electronic processing. That's why, on the deepest level, Finnegan's Wake is not to be understood. He's showing you why it can't be understood. You can't say this is that and that is this.
Right.
And so and simultaneously, that's an electric effect. That's all over the place. But he means in this sentence, the most overt clarification, and simultaneously, non-formulation of raunch epistemology ever. He could take any lyric from any song and make this point. I mean, it has to be approximately like what's being made in Strawberry Fields, but there's probably others, unless it is the only one, Strawberry Fields, and it's the epistemology that's trying to understand the meanings of words, but it is really about the meanings of the new language, electronic effect.
Right.
So the whole process of Strawberry Fields, what it's trying to do, what the Beatles are wrestling with, is a fact. It's a metaphor for the larger electronic ground effect, and that's what McLuhan saw. Meltzer is getting close to that, but it's like if you try to understand some complex thing, you will talk it a million different ways as you try to process it to figure it out. Once you get it, you then say it very simply.
Right?
And so this is the thing. Meltzer is talking, he's the phase before he gets McLuhan's point. And so once you get McLuhan's, real simple. But he's groping towards that, but he can't get that, so he's still trying to understand it. That's the struggle going on in the whole book. But he really knows what the issues are, or at least he's expressing what his experience of these contradictions and excitements.
Right.
You know, it's typical. You're sitting there, you've worked hard all day, maybe you were a garbage man, you lifted garbage vans all day, you're sitting in your truck going home and you're just fucking exhausted, but you turn on the radio and you can get stimulated by the music.
Yeah.
You know, it's and if you didn't have the radio, you'd still be tired. And your body is probably, your mind gets stimulated. Your emotions, your body's still exhausted. It's like injecting a drug in you, which is why, you know, all of medicine went into drug orientation, because they were just trying to keep up with the electric effect. So sleep is a surefire actual conceptual. It's an actual conceptual, not an actual death, a conceptual death closure, etc. So, okay, so this abundance of that is the most overt clarification and non-formalization indicated by such masterfully fluid knowledge guidelines. So see, fluid knowledge guidelines is a good way to what goes on in Finnegan's and Finnegan's Wake. You're using categories but knowing they're falling away as soon as you say them, because the electronic environment, you can't see it, you can't categorize it. So masterfully, so if you want to show that process, you make statements like, it must be high or low, all wrong, that is a think, I disagree, you know I know, and it's a dream, you know I know when it's a dream. There should be contradictions perceived in these sentences, but they're both included, because it's a flow.
Right.
For the chemical body, or whatever that is, fluid knowledge guidelines, that is, whatever that is a perfect reversal of Platonic Cartesian certainty. You don't have certainty, don't have literary certainty about, well, we know this is what the book says, and this is what our experience shows us. It's a reversal of that certainty, and the certainty of what? For being awake knowingly. See, you can't be awake knowingly. The chemical body, the literal body, cannot be awake unless it sees the environment, only when you're actually awake. See, when he says only when you're actually awake, that means when you're living in an electronic landscape. You
right.
cannot be awake knowingly only when you're actually awake. See, it's juvenile complication of a simple McLuhan point. You see what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
He's actually writing it wrong. He doesn't have to say that way, because it just confuses the person. Or whatever that is, it's a perfect reversal. See, the reversal of certainty for being awake knowingly, that's what's reversed. The question is you reversing also only when you're actually awake? I don't think so. It's just reverse. It's just going from literate into tactile experience. And tactile is a fluid, figure-ground flow. Okay?
Yep.
That's the way primitive people, non-literate, pre-literate people are. The last prior time this type of philosophical reversal occurred was in I Want to Tell You. I wonder what song that is.
That's the Beatles as well, but that's like, you know, something from about 66 or so. I think it's like Reversor Revolver era.
Okay. Now, this is really good. The last prior time this type of philosophical reversal occurred was in I Want to Tell You, which is like 2 months before, or 3 months, I mean, 2 years
yeah.
before. This
sure.
whole process of the chemical body over a 12 or 18-month period, writing songs, trying to define what's going on in chemical body terms, is frustrated that you actually get an insight, put it out, and the electronic explosion of information, it drowns in that, and then you can actually redo that philosophical chemical body dilemma 2 years later, and everybody's forgotten what happened 2 years before. You already did it. But the chemical body becomes aware of arriving at those contradictions, uncertainties or incompletions every couple of years, because the electronic body is living 200 years every 12 months
sure.
in terms of what you process. So he's showing the tetradic effect that's going on in the media. It's a very good point. But you have to take, he's showing this, hey, Bob, guess what? I noticed this is a reversal of something 2 years ago. And I go, well, Richard, this is why. It's the chemical body. Can't come up with platitudes for the consumers and philosophical statements and upset the visual certainties of Plato and Descartes, but it all falls away under the onslaught of more and more stuff. So it can be retrieved and redone. It's like, that's what you mean by being virtual. The Beatles, all they could do was sing about the chemical body, so they redid the themes they had done 2 years before.
Right. So are you kind of saying about Meltzer that he's very good at the...
The syndrome, the symptoms.
Pattern recognition, but not the explanation for it?
Yeah, he's very good at laying out the symptoms of what people are experiencing.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, that's good enough just to have someone spell out the weird anomalies of the crazy experience that we were having in the 60s. But he doesn't know, here's the antidote for that. Understand you got more than one body.
Right, okay.
He's presenting the virus that everybody's infected with.
Yeah.
Which is an awareness, not an unawareness, about two realities going on. Two landscapes, the chemical body and the TV, electronic landscape.
Right.
So you watch, he'll keep proving my points. Let's see. There may have been, I think I got that covered. I think we got it.
Yeah.
There might have been some details I didn't get exactly. But anyways, this is...
And I say, Bob, let's, just to put a, to sort of figure out this how we're going to finish this off tonight, because I don't want to go too much longer. Even
right.
This is good stuff. Let's see if we can get through the next two paragraphs on page 251. Short paragraphs, because the paragraph that comes after that, the third paragraph, that's really key and really insightful, and I don't think we'd have time to start.
No, we'll do that next time.
Starting it tonight. Yeah, we'll start there in the next session. So
okay, so he says
these next two.
So he says, the growing awareness that there was an American shore multiplicity variety, lots of new groups, move taking place. See, there's the the radio environment needs content. In the FM environment, in the new FM radio. Dylan and the Beatles came. They can't keep it all going. They crash in different ways, right? How can anybody provide all the content? You don't even need famous groups. You just have to have anybody putting stuff out. And that's why Paola was there, because anybody could be famous if they're any reasonable, competent group could be famous on the radio. So the manager said, no, my groups will get in, not yours, because we know that anybody can be famous. You see,
right,
the background. So here you have new technologies coming in, new guitars and electronic instruments and Marshall amps or whatever, and it's just endless creativity. And so that's this whole new phase, the psychedelic rock phase, the growing awareness that there was an American shore multiplicity variety, lots of new groups move. See, that's what was that previous line, rest as move. Rest became a move, so that was temporary.
Yeah, right.
We're now past that. We're now just new stuff. There's all kinds of stuff we can put out there. Anybody can make a play a guitar. That's the move taking place. So I think the death rest period is just before the psychedelic thing. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Makes sense. So Mothers, Airplane, Love, Buffalo Springfield, Moby Great, Grateful Dead, The Hint of Big Brother and the Holding Company. Oh, great music, right?
Yep.
But it's not hard to make great music when you can play electronic guitar, because just the electronic squeal is you're going to like it, right?
Right.
And whatever else you put in there, musical ability, is gravy. Okay, so the growing awareness that there was an American shore, multiplicity, variety, both heightened the tension and made it easier to bear. Heightened the tension, the dilemma for the chemical body, which wonders, can I keep up with consuming all this stuff? And made it easier to bear because, as long as you can enjoy the electronic body, and it's not as that can be assuaged.
Right, okay.
But Tim Buckley, part of this wave, confided in me. He has note 215, February 67, in Memphis, Sam Perlman's car with Noonan and Jackson, too. So those are his buddies, especially Sam Perlman. Confided in me and everybody else that he wanted to see the Beatles come back. And in brackets, their album absence was getting longer and longer. So there's Tim, probably inspired by the Beatles. That's his own nostalgia, for that to him was meaningful, the Beatles phase. And whatever energy he got from that, he wanted that. He wanted that chemical body thing. But how could it come back? There's millions of groups since the Beatles. I mean, it's fraudulent even to say the Beatles were the greatest band. There were so many other great bands making one-hit wonders. That's good enough. I don't care how many other hits they make. Just give me one. And there's all kinds of great music. That's what McLuhan said, it was tribal. It's only industrial society that says one person is better than another. That's for marketing money stuff, and even that doesn't work. Because most people get it for free anyways in the electronic utopia.
Yeah. Well, and the Aesthetics of Rock, the book, is I think it makes that argument over and over again as well. So, I mean, the Beatles are central to the book, but not really, actually. And that's one of the points that Greil Marcus makes in his introduction, is that there's some, forgotten hit by the Searchers that he treats as just as important as anything from Sgt. Pepper sort of thing.
Right, and then it's also being processed, I didn't like James Taylor or something, but 20 years later I might hear the song, might be in a mood, I'll like it.
Yeah.
I don't even say what I like. I never said what I like, because I know it's always changing. And
there's
so much great stuff constantly.
Yeah, and that's what I more and more, the older I got and I was continuing to try and write my own music criticism, I found that was something that was kind of difficult to deal with, is be putting in print that I didn't like, especially didn't like something. If I liked something, I didn't care if later I changed my mind. But just to say in print that I couldn't stand something or it sucked, I always knew I'd end up getting burned by it. Part of me just didn't care. I thought, well, that's just the way it works. But very often it'd be like, I know I'll get burned by this because I know, like, I'll hear it, you know, in the right context 3 months later. And, you know, and then I'll sound like, oh, my criticisms were just like, I was taking it too seriously, or I was being silly about that, you know.
It was fun. What you're expressing, what was that last line? It was fun?
Yeah, like I might hear something later. And
yeah, it's fun.
I think, you know, this is great. Like, you know, I'm hung up about this.
What you just described, I don't think you've said this before, but that's exactly the syndrome we're talking about that every writer had to deal with. The obsolescence of what you're writing.
Yeah.
You know, it's silly. And that's very good what you just said. That's the point, the syndrome I'm talking about.
But you still, I mean, it may be a syndrome, but there's nothing wrong with doing that, I guess. But I don't know, for me it was just
It's ephemeral. Just know that you're just satisfying the eye. The Western culture needs stuff to read. You're just providing hamburgers for them.
Right.
And anybody else can replace you. Other people can write stuff. It's almost like, let's just pretend we have an opinion, and I'll write a bunch of shit and pretend it's real. The more you understand the transitoriness of that, the healthier you'll be.
Yeah, that's I think what it is.
But most people, they want to have solid, literate meaning. They want a private identity that's secure. That's the way people are. They want an identity. And this world does not encourage that possibility.
Yeah.
No way can you have one.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you write something and you get it published in, you know, a zine or a weekly paper or something, you know, there's no problem with, like, thinking that, okay, so people are going to read this week, and that's the vibe, like, I'm feeling about this record, and it's all kind of good. It's kind of when it gets retrieved or something, 6 months down the road or something, and then it's like, okay, well, wait a second.
Yeah, and if your stuff is retrieved, just tell them, hey, that's 1,000 years ago. I'm a 5 different people since then.
Yeah,
don't be
so
naive. Why are you even reading my stuff? It's not relevant.
Yeah.
Well, you get paid for it. Yeah, I managed to get a contract to write this stuff, and you didn't. So that's the, as McLuhan said, art is whatever you can get away with. Living the last 40 years has been whatever you can get away with.
Well, and that's for me, that's kind of why maybe DJing ended up being something I actually enjoyed more than writing.
Yeah, you weren't held accountable for it.
Well, and it's you're like, that's the job of it, is actually to capture the moment.
Yeah.
It's not to put some, like, sort of frame around it and explain that, you know, like, try and over-contextualize it or something. I'm talking kind of in circles here.
No, it makes total sense. I mean, that's it. You're only there to stimulate the androids, the robotoids, you know, and they have a great time, and that's it. Next day, it doesn't matter who's spinning the disc, and if you can get the gig, don't mind, you do it, but someone else can do it. Doesn't matter who's doing it.
Yeah.
It's a collective, it's so what McLuhan's talking about. It's a collective ritual available every day.
Yeah.
A collective electronic stimulated utopia. But the chemical body finds it hard to relate to that.
Exactly.
It gets exhausted. Everybody screws up eventually on the chemical body level.
So,
but Tim Buckley, part of this wave, was part of this wave, confided in me and everybody else that he wanted to see the Beatles come back. Their album absence was getting longer and longer. So he just wanted the album to come back, I guess, not just their live concerts. But the Beatles...
I think that was a known thing at the time, just to add this in. Not a known thing, but I've read before that I think with Sgt. Pepper, they had created this real anticipation because the gap between albums was longer than previous. So I think that's what he's kind of talking about there.
Yeah, and it's Tim, his chemical body, yearning for a continuity, and that let's have the Beatles every now and then. And if they aren't coming back, then I got no continuity.
Right.
And I can't hang. I don't like that. So you can't even call nostalgia. It's a physiological effect of the turnover of so much entertainment. You just want to get an anchor in it, no matter who you are. And so for him, it was the Beatles.
Right.
And everybody else, he wanted to see the Beatles come back and knock them out one more time, and really knock them out this time. He thought them dead. What a
It's a bit of an odd sentence.
He thought them dead, what a pity, for that would mean that in a way the whole thing had died without an official time of death. Now there, see, okay. there's my point. Not, it never dies in electronic terms. Okay, he thought them dead, what a pity, for that would mean that in a way the whole thing had died without an official time of death. So, you see, there's no death in the electronic thing, but your chemical body wants to put significance and markers and boundaries to what you think is real and what's valuable and what isn't. So, for Buckley, the Beatles were the alpha and the omega. And if they don't come back, then the TV iconography is dead.
And I didn't even know when it died.
Yeah, when it happened. And it did not happen. It only happened for Tim.
Right, right.
I mean, all these dilemmas, I mean, the Beatles come back many times and many big movies and specials and everything, and so on it goes, and new people are just hearing it. It always amazed me. I would hear people listening to the Beatles in the 80s, I don't know, younger people, and yeah. I used to think that I was in my own chemical body monkey brain. Well, that's 20 years ago, and these guys are, I mean, there's a lot better stuff than that that's happened since then, you know, but it was all new for them. And, you know, you can look at these musical phases, these styles of music represent a collective mood, and people surf all these moods, and you're going to want to experience all of them. So there's a whole atmosphere that the Beatles give off in the mid-60s. There's a whole atmosphere that psychedelic rock gives off, different atmosphere, and the later generations surf those mimic atmospheres. And they're like holograms. You live in the Beatles, so it's not odd that someone in the 80s is joining the Beatles. They're just into that. They're experiencing that mood for the first time.
Yeah.
And we've had these recycling moods ever since 1945 with endlessly new moods being created. So we'll just quick up. He goes, then New York mine disaster 1941 by the Bee Gees. Right, the Bee Gees. That just had to be a pseudonym. It sounded too much like Revolver period Beatles stuff. And Brian Epstein was a Bee Gees manager too. But then photos of the Bee Gees appeared. So hunger for the actual being greater than it ever was for the possible.
That I like that. So he's kind of almost saying that it's the Bee Gees were almost like this fake. They're playing like a game almost. Like, is this really the Beatles?
They're recycling the Beatles' mood.
Right, right.
And look at this. So hunger for the actual, for the Beatles, became greater than it ever was for the possible. So the hunger for the discarded effect of watching, experiencing an album of the Beatles, provided by the Bee Gees, was greater than it ever was for the possible chemical body return of them.
Right, right.
Right there. It's totally obvious what I'm saying. So hunger for the actual became greater. The actual is actually the discarded electronic input, greater than it ever was for the possible. The possible was them showing up. It's actually... They can't even be, you can't have a Beatles album. So hunger for the actual became greater than it ever was for the possible. What is the possible in that sentence?
Yeah, I don't understand what
okay.
the possible is.
Well, I'll try it. So hunger for the actual became greater than it ever was for the possible. The hunger, the Bee Gees are the possible. And the hunger, they don't satisfy the hunger. The actual is an actual Beatles album.
Yeah, the actual is the Beatles, for sure.
Yeah, so hunger for the Beatles became greater than ever was for the possible. There was no hunger for the Bee Gees, but the Bee Gees did satisfy a fill-in period because it was a general mood that the Beatles identify with, but there was many other groups part of that, and you just need to approximate the music of that time, and you generate the retrieval of that mood.
Right.
So this sentence is may not be perfect, maybe the wrong word possible, but again, it's the two-bodied scenario, two-landscape, two-bodied scenario. That's what he's writing about. That's what everybody's experiencing, and hats off for Meltzer to allow himself to think it.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Or to notice what he was experiencing without any matching literary standards or literary factional employment possibilities.
I'd still be amazed to hear what he would think about your interpretation of this.
Yeah, his chemical body, monkey brain, may not be strong enough to take it.
Yeah.
And he may, since he doesn't get it, he basically never gets it, then I suspect he'll be upset with it because it'll remind him of the problem he didn't resolve. Because he's a failed McLuhan student.
Interesting.
Okay, so you got to go, right?
Yeah, so let's leave it at that. I think that's an excellent place to end. And when we pick this up, maybe we'll just do a quick recap of what he sort of laid out for us, and then go into the next section, which is just I think it's like a key paragraph for the book, and I think we could almost do a whole episode on the next paragraph or two probably. So.
Okay, great. I enjoyed doing this.
Excellent, Bob. That was great stuff as usual. Good to talk to you.
Okay, Scott.
I was in a shitty mood tonight, and I'm glad we did this. So.
Oh, you feel better?
Yeah, I do.
This is still part of the recording.
I'm fine if it is, sure.
Okay, everybody. Scott's been healed again. I don't know if he'll make through the next week or two, but...
That's right.
He's ready to meet this onslaught again.
That's right.
Just keep your earphones on. Keep entertaining yourself. All that stuff you guys do on Rock Critics, you're actually consuming all that stuff that you produce on there?
I haven't even done anything on there in a long time, actually, so...
So that's not, I never can tell who's writing what. Maybe if I look closer, it says,
it's
but...
It's mostly this other girl who's basically kind of taken over the site at this point, so...
And she's consuming all that stuff.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Well, just another junkie.
Hey, but now's a good time for me to put in a plug for, all the thousands of listeners out there to stay tuned for my upcoming interview with Dave Neufeld.
Oh, you're going to do that? That's great.
Yeah, no, we've already started it, so.
Well, that's the standard. I set the standard, so you're going to have to top what I did with them.
That's right. Well, you got some stiff competition now, Bob, so.
Yeah, you're the Frank Zappa here. You watch me, Dylan, go forward and do it, and then you're going to... Not you're gonna avoid the same the pitfalls I went into.
That's right.
Okay, great.
We will talk soon.
Okay.
Thanks,
okay. Yeah. Bye.